This separateness is nowhere more evident than in discussions of experience near and experience distant language, a distinction originating in the framework of Austrian psychoanalyst Heinz Kohut and imported into cultural anthropology by Clifford Geertz in his famous piece From a Native's Point of View. It's critically important and fascinating to realize that Kohut used this distinction to emphasize two modes of using language in psychoanalysis, the experience near being empathic and mirroring the client's point of view, the experience distant being analytical and socio-emotionally more detached from the client. While Geertz used this distinction to emphasize two kinds of symbolic representation. For Kohut, successful psychoanalysis initially requires experience near communication in which one palpably experiences another's person's self-understandings, or, quote, those former split off and perhaps discarded fragments of oneself. Kohut's encounters with narcissistic persons led him to realize the import of experience near listening. Eventually, as cure draws closer, the analyst is able to communicate more abstract interpretations. But at this later point in the therapeutic process, these concepts resonate with the client's self-explorations and the client can absorb them. The goal for Kohut was to enlarge the client's self-understanding through first engaging in empathic experience near mirroring so that eventually the client can embrace experience distant understandings of self. Alternatively, for Geertz, a primary goal was to address the transcendent ethnographic enterprise of reconciling native, that is, experience near, and anthropological, that is, experience distance terms and concepts, in the face of hermeneutic obstacles to cross-cultural interpretation. While Kohut prized experience near communication for its empathic potency, Geertz warned that, quote, confinement to experience near concepts leaves an ethnographer awash in immediacies as well as entangled in vernacular. Indeed, Geertz argued that empathy is not necessary for anthropological understanding of the other. Only go as far as needed, he seems to say, and this is a quote, to produce an interpretation of the way a people lives which is neither imprisoned within their mental horizons nor systematically deaf to the distinctive tonalities of their existence, unquote. In this sense, Geertz's experience near and experience distant were simply two conceptual poles in a delicate translation process. Geertz's view of experience near and experience far language as symbolic is the natural attitude in much of psychological anthropology, and there is a continued confusion regarding this distinction. The focus on language as symbolic in anthropology and other disciplines carries with it a preoccupation with language as an inauthentic representation of ideas, emotions, and other entities. An abiding concern with language and authenticity has consumed scholars and artists across the 20th century. William James, for example, declared the authentic pure self to be, quote, what exists underneath or beyond the conventional being that we have become as a result of conforming to how others in society have shaped us. Similarly, in Being and Time, Heidegger vilified ordinary talk as inauthentic and idle talk that gives rise to spurious identities. And novelist Robert Musil's 1930s masterpiece, The Man Without Qualities, was populated by superficial characters who spoke in dead metaphors, bureaucratic formulas, and shallow cultural code words with a mechanical certainty that frustrated the central anti-hero, Ulrich, who alternatively craved to break through to his own true self. A host of other intellectuals, including Nietzsche, Marx, Freud, Sartre, Lacan, Foucault, Bourdieu, and Zizek, and others, have portrayed everyday conversational discourse as constricting, robotic, and morally impoverished. Here I have an example from Zizek, who recently writes, "Reality in itself, in its stupid existence, is never intolerable. It's language, it's symbolization, which makes it such." In these frameworks, the solution to the mindless and imprisoning force of everyday language is to violate language conventions in some way. For example, through theatrical or literary works that call attention to and use language in marked ways, through political critiques of entrenched discourse genres, through psychoanalysis, or, as Freud suggests, through madness. These laments implicate a view of society itself as artificial, deceptive, and hence immoral. This perspective breaks with the more positive image of the relation between person and community that prevailed among Greek philosophers such as Aristotle. The roots of the more drastic view of public social life can be traced back to at least the 16th century, when feudalism gave way to the possibility of upward social mobility through wealth and good manners. The insincere deployment of fawning etiquette to gain social class privileges was widely deplored in post-feudal France. Over the centuries, everyday language has become at the heart of this disregard. The focus on language as an inauthentic, symbolic system also implicates a world independent of semiotic representations. Somewhere underneath the idle talk is an essential reality to be unmasked. Although this perspective characterized Wittgenstein's early work, he later argued to the contrary, that arguments for language-transcendent essences constitute just another language game. This pragmatic perspective aligns with Heidegger's insight that language is an active force in attaining moment by moment, contingently and fragilely, the primordial experience of being present in the world. Along the same lines, Gadamer, and more recently Agamben, argue that the separation of language and world is conceptually flawed. In Agamben's framework, for example, far from being a sign of developmental immaturity or primordial thinking, all human beings integrate linguistic symbols into how they understand entities denoted by those symbols. Agamben uses the relation of the term shoe to the concept shoe as a case in point. He notes that although people generally do not confuse the acoustic or graphic form of shoe with the object shoe signified, the social fact that the object shoe is called shoe constitutes a crucial, what he calls, non-predicative property that belongs to each of the class of shoes. In other words, being called shoe is part of the idea of shoe. Agamben is not forwarding a Worfian argument here, but rather making the more abstract point that language forms per se seep into the world of signification. From this perspective, any language form that is part of one's working repertoire is inherently experience near and foundational to individual and to community. Agamben's position echoes Heidegger's insistence that language is the gateway to experiencing the world. Heidegger enigmatically proposed that naming objects is a kind of call that bids humans to come nearer to things in the world. Okay, and this moves me to the second view that I'd like to talk about. The focus on language as symbolic representation in anthropological research on culture and experience is generally narrowed to individual words. The fascination with words is a legacy of structuralism with its categories and features. In psychological anthropology, single words continue to figure large, not the least of which as cultural keys to fathoming the ethos of a community. The focus on words is also heavily present in Lacanian influence scholarship, which disparages the violence of words as authoritative master signifiers that lock concepts into symbolic fields. Zizek, for example, writes that, quote, when we name gold, gold, we violently extract a metal from its natural texture, investing in it our dreams of wealth, power, spiritual purity, and so on, which have nothing to do with the immediate reality of gold. Language, of course, is more than words. Language users combine words into larger units to express complex meaning relations. While appreciating the despair over the imposition of public signifiers, as a linguistic anthropologist, I am under the thrall of how morphosyntactic forms can also encode nuanced, all-important, temporal, epistemic, affective, modal, actional, stative, attributive, and locative meanings. I have used these forms to illuminate the everyday subjective and intersubjective worlds of children diagnosed with autism, adults with agoraphobia, physicists struggling to understand atomic spins, and children's development of compassion across societies. And I am baffled why so many scholars so often do not insist on finer linguistic discriminations in fathoming the intricate sociocultural and individual architecture of mental processes, states, and conditions. And this brings me to the third view, the incomplete indexical character of everyday language is largely underappreciated in anthropological studies of culture and experience. While the incompleteness of language has been widely addressed in anthropology and in other disciplines, in important ways, the incompleteness of language begs further consideration. What is striking across many psychocultural analyses is that everyday language's incapacity to render experience adequately concentrates on intense experiences such as pain, grief, and trauma. From a linguistic perspective, however, these poignant examples manifest a far more systemic property of languages, namely that languages are built to be incomplete representations of the world. A century ago, Boas pointed out in his writings on Native American languages and cultures that languages cannot and do not provide one-on-one mappings of forms to meanings, since the range of personal experience is infinitely varied. Instead, languages are inherently categorical, with a limited set of forms available to convey a range of meanings. Languages are imprecise in expressing all sorts of meanings, from colors to sounds to tastes to mathematical functions. Of course, for Lacanians and Neo-Worfians alike, it's precisely language's systemic condensation of meanings that distorts human experience. Yet what is missing from some of these arguments is that the incompleteness of language on the symbolic level is compensated somewhat by an additional capacity of language, its indexical character. As many of you know, in Peirce's account, a semiotic index conveys meaning through an awareness of an existential, cultural, physical, or even personal association obtaining among objects. The index points, here is attention, to a mental representation, for example, a rise in temperature, associated with another mental representation, for example, mercury level in a thermometer. The index does not resemble the object that it represents. An index assumes reliance on the immediate context of situation and the broader context of culture, as Malinowski would say, to be understood. Perhaps the purest exemplar of an indexical form is the pronoun I, which indicates a self in the immediate or removed but always relevant context. What is critical is that the pronominal form I is relatively empty without the context. As noted incisively by Silverstein, language cannot be understood independently of the context. It is integral to, indeed presupposes and constitutes, the world in which it's embedded. In the case at hand, the pronoun I and the situated self each bring the other into existence. As Agamben puts it, pronouns are themselves exposures of being. The indexical character of language reaches far beyond pronouns. Communication itself rests upon a kind of conceptual language context or orchestration that members of communities are capable of imagining, wherein language forms provide just enough meaning to invoke past, present, and projected culturally or personally meaningful contexts. As Toni Morrison noted in her 1993 Nobel lecture, language arcs toward the place where meaning may lie. This is a beautiful image of indexicality, as not so much an explicit pointing to a context that is outside of language, but rather a gesturing of language towards a potential realm of meanings that are brought into consciousness through the linguistic gesture. Indexicality exquisitely displays how incompleteness systematically and creatively brings together language and context. Like Agamben's analysis of the term shoe and the object shoe, language and the world, language and subjectivity, language and emotion, language and consciousness are all intertwined and bring each other into meaningful being for better or for worse. And this brings me to the fourth point concerning the consideration of everyday language in the anthropological studies of culture and experience. View four is that psychological anthropology's focus on language as symbol and related preoccupation with authenticity has largely occluded a view of everyday language in motion as an experience in itself. The discussion thus far has been inching towards a larger point regarding the relation of language to experience. In advocating everyday language be considered within psychological anthropology as not only symbolic and separated from the world, but also indexically part of the world, I am petitioning to view ordinary enactments of language as modes of experiencing the world. This alignment is related to, but not the same as saying that language shapes experience, as captured in the writings of Boas, Sapir, and Worf. Nor is it saying that language is a form of action, as in philosophical approaches to performatives and speech acts promoted by Austin, Searle, and Butler. Performatives and speech acts are generally analyzed as modes of social conduct whose force depends upon certain situated felicity conditions. Beyond doing things, however, enactments of language are also experienced as they are produced and as they are perceived. Listen, for example, to how an 11-year-old Adam, a boy who's been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, how he tells his mother about his first day at middle school. In this excerpt, Adam recounts with a great deal of relish the times at which the class periods begin and end. Here's hoping the sound works. Whoops.
And then five, you would think the tides are
no.
Crazy. The tides.
That's not working very well. You can hear that? I was thinking I will try that again. I can find where the speaker is here.
And then five, but you would think the tides are crazy. The tides with the period ends as the period starts are unbelievable.
What?
The first period starts at 8:31, not 8:30, 8:31.
Oh, I see.
And
that's why, you know why? Because they think everybody's going to be in their place at 8:30. Well, does the bell ring at 25 after, or are you just supposed to be there at 8:30?
No, it rings just three bells. One at 27 after.
Okay, warning bell.
And then there's one at 25 and then one at 20.
Oh, so you don't need a watch.
Yeah.
You won't know what bell is. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Yeah, and then so the first class, Mrs. Brown says, starts at 8:31.
Oh,
and ends, you would think this is really crazy. At 9:28.
Oh, that's a long class.
Yeah. At 9:28.
And that's almost an hour.
Yeah. So then it ends at 9:28. So then that's that. And then so at 9:28, I walked over to Mrs. Gretch's room. It's right by the office, right next door.
Okay. So you all have noted the repetitions in Adam's account related to the autistic proclivity to perseverate. Yet you will also have caught Adam's great delight at repeating, paraphrasing, and contrasting expressions like, you will think the times are crazy, the times are unbelievable, 8:31, 8:30, 8:31, you know, and then all the repetitions of 8:28. Like rocking back and forth and spinning, the voice repetitions of the class times are co-experienced by Adam and his mother as emergent sources of shared laughter and pleasure. Lest one think of language as an everyday experience is restricted to the autism spectrum, the emergent production of utterances, whether spoken, written, signed, or otherwise, whether casual or whether formal, whether idle chatter or a creative epiphany, is a phenomenological undertaking for neurotypically intact persons of all ages. This petition argues against the idea that speaking and listening, writing and reading are necessarily unconscious and automatic rollouts of thoughts and feelings formulated anterior to and outside of enactments of language. Rather, subjective experience is formed to an as yet undetermined extent in the course of phonological and orthographic enactments. Unfolding meaning is both a social and personal creation, wherein, unlike a hand fan unfurling in a predetermined array, significance is built through and experienced in temporal bursts of sense-making, often in coordination with others, often left hanging in realms of ambiguity. Linguistic anthropology shares with psychological anthropology the idea that experience is a watershed between the individual and the social. In this perspective, thoughts and feelings are not so much things as they are courses that run through and revive our being in the world. As Agamben notes in The Coming Community, the passage from potentiality to act is not an event accomplished once and for all, but an infinite series of modal oscillations the individuation of a singular existence is not a punctual fact, but varies in every direction according to a continual gradation of growth and remission, of appropriation and impropriation. Yet, while linguistic and psychological anthropologists alike struggle to fathom the experiential contours of person and society, there's not nearly enough rigorous bridging of our subfields in this scholarly undertaking. In particular, the spotty points of contact across the subfields have meant that we understand little about how embodied, situated enactments of language in situ articulate with thinking, feeling, consciousness, and the incessant emergence, to use Agamben's expression, of existence. While we cannot claim that ordinary conversation is flooded with full-blown phenomenological modifications in which the world as interlocutors know it is re-envisioned, it is the site of constant instances of incipient phenomenal bracketings, jump-started by hesitations, word searches, and self-repairs. Experience near concepts in this light are far from unself-conscious, as Geertz once posited. And if self is made most evident in conditions of uncertainty, then ordinary, informal conversation is the Baroque site for working out situated versions of who we think we are through clumsy propositions in the making and disjointed narratives of personal experience. So Victor Turner, many decades ago, proposed that social dramas enacted in theater and ritual bring participants into an experience through the power of aesthetics and performance. What I'm petitioning here is an extension of these existential affordances to everyday informal encounters. There is an everyday way of living experience wherein linguistic enactments become themselves temporally unfolding experiences whose configuration at any moment is influenced by the voices, bodies, and dispositions of others present and non-present, and by a calculation of the situation at hand. Turner further argued that theater transpired in what he called the subjunctive mood of culture, that is, the mood of maybe, might be, as if, hypothesis, fantasy, conjecture, desire, while ordinary life transpires in what he calls the indicative mood, where we accept the invariant operation of cause and effect, of rationality and common sense. That's his quote. The work of discourse analysts undermines this distinction. Indeed, the subjunctive mood is very much in evidence in ordinary life, where doubt is endemic, and where causal relations and logics are pieced together contingently, situationally, and non-linearly, as much as they draw from a bank of a priori knowledge, beliefs, dispositions, and expectations. In this perspective, utterance meaning cannot always be treated as a holistic proposition. Rather, meaning is evolving over interactional time as an emergent experience. Nor is utterance meaning simply the sum of its meaning at different points in utterance time. The meaning of any utterance or text transcends its momentary parts, and we have yet to have a proper grasp of how to analyze it. A transcript and a translation plunks an utterance down in its entirety. But we know that this representation belies the temporal experience of ordinary meaning-making, in which feelings may build and diminish, thoughts may be initiated and withdrawn, repetitions may involve poetic qualities, and the sound of one's own and others' intonations, voice qualities and rhythms, or alternatively one's own or one's interlocutor's silences, feed back into the living experience of enacted language. It's the aim of this paper to invite a more generous morality of everyday language in psychological anthropology and beyond. The hero of Foucault and of Lacan breaks away from conventional societal technologies, especially language, to carve an authentic self. While honoring the ravages of institutional discourses, the hero for me, and perhaps for other linguistic anthropologists, is the one who allows herself or himself to be vulnerable to the contingent informality of ordinary enacted language and thereby to learn, that is, to grow. In other words, take a close look at the unfolding ordinary utterance to find the imaginary intertwined with the conventional. Interlocutors involved in everyday situations are certainly at times consumed by conventional tropes, but at other times they are thoroughly consumed by the imaginative force of language at hand, and or uncertain, awkward crafters of meaning, painting and repainting what matters in the flow of their lives. In informal conversation, topics wander recklessly far from expectations. Conflicts and misunderstandings erupt, and emotions turn hot or cold in a flash. Recounting a narrative of past experience around a family dinner table, for example, may suddenly give way to present time feelings of anxiety and betrayal that rush forth in and through talk and hurtful actions. Such vicissitudes of emotion have been examined in psychotherapeutic encounters, but we know very little indeed about the temporally developing and enveloping flows of emotion in informal communication around the world. The biblical study of Samson and Delilah strikes me as an apt trope for what can happen when one goes home to the everyday contingencies of domestic life. One's secrets may be revealed and powers diminished, all at the beckoning of an intimate in the throes of spontaneous informality. To summarize, this presentation petitions scholars addressing culture and experience to infuse sensibilities about existential doubt, suffering, desire, morality, empathy, mind reading, healing, temporality, transformation, sense of self, and the making of persons with sensibilities about the indexical formation of language and context as a single, primal, coherent unit of meaning, and to treat perfectly ordinary enactments of language as themselves experiential moments that have everything to do with the psychic management of life's contingencies. In this interdisciplinary petition, the distinction between experience near and experience distant misses the fundamental point that language, once in motion, and experience are conjoined. Experience, even the drama of pain, lies outside, inside, and alongside enacted language as its indexical resource. Thank you.